crossroads of empires, battleground of the ages, city of peace and of war. This is Jerusalem, where archaeology uncovers the empires of yesterday, where prophecy decodes the headlines of today. This is where history and prophecy come alive. This is Watch Jerusalem.
Welcome back to Watch Jerusalem. I'm your host, Brent Nuchtigal. We're coming to you today from Edmond, Oklahoma. That's where I am, but I have somebody else on the line. He is in Britain, one of our writers for Watch Jerusalem, archaeologist Christopher Eames. He's been putting together a series on Watch Jerusalem, and if you've been to our website, watchjerusalem.co.il, you've no doubt seen his writing on the Bible's buried civilizations, looking at the civilizations, the peoples that the Bible talks about, not just the Israelites, but who the Israelites are interacting with, be it the Canaanites, the Assyrians, Egyptians, and so on. Well, the latest article that he has written refers to the ancient people of Babylon. And he's on the line here to talk about that article with me today. So thank you very much, Chris, for taking some time out to talk to us.
No problem. Good to be here again.
It's always a pleasure to get your perspective on some of these peoples that we've read so much about in the Bible for years, and then just to see the backstory, their own personal backstory, and fill in some of the details of just the way that they lived, and what's out there in archaeology and secular sources, and see how that compares with the Bible. So let's get right into this article covering the Babylonians. We know a lot, I guess, of this famous incident that took place in the early book of Genesis about Babel. And I wonder if you can just make it clear what the connection is between Babel and the Babylonians.
Sure. Well, just after the flood occurred, readers might be familiar with this story. What we have is humanity not quite yet dispersed around the earth. We still have humanity living and dwelling together. And what we read about in the Bible is we have this chief leader, Nimrod, the first real despot that we kind of see on the world scene. And he leads the majority of humanity at that time to come together and to build some kingdoms for him. And now the Bible, Genesis 11 begins, Genesis 10 and Genesis 11, talks about how Babylon was the beginning of his kingdom. And that's variously translated. Babel is the Hebrew, Bavel is the Hebrew word for it, King James Version, and Babel. And that is Babylon, the first of his kingdoms, and then the Bible proceeds to list a variety of other kingdoms he helped establish. So we have this first foundational kingdom that Nimrod set up. And it's within that first kingdom, Babel, that we have his tower, his famous Tower of Babel, that was set up. Now, readers of the Bible will be familiar with how, as they were setting this tower up, God saw the tower and basically said, what man has come together to do isn't right, and we need to disperse them from coming together and building this tower. And Josephus adds some extra light, saying that that mankind at that time was intending to build this tower in order to be able to reach heaven and survive any other flood that God would bring upon mankind. And so God sends basically disperses the people through confounding the languages, through changing the languages of the builders. Through that means he was able to disperse the people that were building that tower.
So this is a pretty bold claim from the Bible that, I mean, it makes sense that they would build a tower like this under the leadership of this man, Nimrod. Is there anything outside the Bible, or I wonder if you can comment on outside sources from the Bible? You said Josephus writes about it. He's a Jewish historian, so people would probably say that he was making this up, this story, 2,000 years after the fact. But I wonder if you could just kind of detail any other outside sources that kind of discuss what happened here at this Tower of Babel.
Certainly. There are quite a number, actually, quite a surprising number when you look at it, of outside sources that refer to what happened, parallel stories We've got a separate article on Watch Jerusalem about that, about the Tower of Babel and those sources. And I describe it in my new article as well on the Babylonians, as we're discussing today. And so we have a number of ancient documents, one of them a Sumerian account from about 2100 BC, that's over 4,000 years old, describing in the context of building a tower, describing enchantments that were attempted in order to bring the language of mankind back into unity so that they could build this tower.
So judging by the dating of that, you said it was 2100 BC or something like that. So that they would almost be, if they've got their dating right of that tablet, that would almost be an eyewitness account, right? That's kind of when the Bible, if we do some backtracking and some chronology with the dating of this event from the Bible, that would put it around the same time.
Certainly. We have the flood dating around 2350 BC, and this Sumerian account around 2100. And now you've got to remember, Nimrod was the great-grandson of Noah. I believe it's the great-grandson. And so judging by that gap in time, that's about the time that Nimrod would have been on the scene. And actually, one of the figures in that Sumerian account called Enmerkar, there is a historian who's actually connected him as possibly being Nimrod himself, based on the meaning of his name being similar to what the Bible discusses of Nimrod.
So just staying with this, I don't want to take too much time up about it, but it is a fantastic parallel here. If the Bible's saying that you have this early founder of Babel builds a tower, languages are confounded, and then you have an almost eyewitness account that has been uncovered through modern archaeology, saying almost exactly the same thing, how come I haven't heard about this?
Well, that's a hard question to answer. Certainly, these things should be more public, and oftentimes a lot of these documents just get filed away and not properly discussed and revealed, and a lot of it goes into scientific bias. It has to fit the narrative of humanity's so-called evolutionary history, and that doesn't fit with the biblical narrative. And so a lot of these things are obviously being hushed down a little bit.
Yeah, I'm happy you bring that to our attention. But I read your article, and you have another document, ancient document, before Josephus, not even from Israel, right, that discusses this event as well.
That's right. This other document is called the Assyrian inscription. This dates to around the 8th to 7th centuries BC. So that's around 700 years before Josephus's time. And this is a damaged inscription. It's actually housed within the British Museum. And it talks about builders essentially on a mound having their language confounded. I have a small quote here from it, if I can read that it mentions these builders and talks about this god that confounded the languages. And it said that their walls all the day he founded, for their destruction in the night he did not leave a remainder. In his anger also, his secret counsel he pours out, to confound their speeches he set his face. He gave the command, he made strange their counsel. End of quote.
That's amazing. You said that was 8th century BC, Assyrian document, writing about, I mean, it's almost like a direct quote from the book of Genesis.
Yeah, it's an incredible document. And incredibly, these things we don't just find within the Middle East. If you look at this and say, well, maybe it isn't just a Jewish story, maybe it's a Middle Eastern story. Well, the Bible talks about with regard to the Tower of Babel, that this was before the dispersion of the peoples all around the world. So if this is true, then we ought to be finding these stories all over the world. And
right.
Do we find that these stories all around the world? And the answer is yes, we do. You can reference my article, The Tower of Babel, and see ancient accounts from the Mesoamericans. from the tribes in Polynesia and Ghana talking about building some form of tower or some form of high masts or some form of construction in order to reach heaven, and then the gods confounding the languages and scattering people.
Yeah, and I'll leave a link for that article that people can go back and just read through that and be dumbfounded. I think I was, because I hadn't studied into this. I tend to stay away from such early biblical history and stay with some things that tend to be more concrete, and that's my fault, because as you've explained, there is a lot of concrete evidence for this. So I'll leave a link for that. As far as the biblical picture after the Tower of Babel, we do have the powerful figure of Abraham coming into contact with Babylonians, and even being brought up underneath kind of that first Babylonian empire. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct. What we have on the scene at Abraham's time is essentially a really big Assyrian empire. The Assyrians were really growing in power at that time. Babylon was really still a powerful entity, but more or less just emerging on the scene. And it was in that emerging power that Abraham grew up. And now if you read through the Bible account, it talks about a federation of kings that came together. These were Assyrian kings, part of this wider, broad Assyrian empire that came together and ended up conducting war in around the region of Israel, before it was Israel, of course. And at that time, Abraham had moved to that land, the land of Canaan there, and he actually fought back against these Assyrian kings with hundreds of his servants. The Bible describes that they were absolutely crushed and wiped out. And now in history at this time period, you have the Assyrian influence diminishing, and you have the Babylonian influence now rising on the scene, as also with Egypt. Egypt obviously being prepared for that time period where the Israelites would end up moving into Egypt and being in captivity. But also you do have this Babylonian rising on the scene around the time of Abraham and on beyond. And one of the notable figures there that history brings out is Hammurabi, one of the Babylonian rulers at the time. And he's quite famous for a code of law that that he came out with. Some of the script on that law, the code of that law, is similar to the phrasing on some of the verses of the Bible. So people draw some distinctions with that, with Hammurabi. And also at that time, we have Job on the scene, as known from the book of Job. And now he is most likely the son of Issachar in the Bible. There's a reference to Job being the son of Issachar. And during his time, one of the curses that befalls Job is a number of Chaldeans attacking Job's flocks of animals. And interestingly, these Chaldeans are part of the wider Babylonian Empire. You can kind of think of Chaldeans as a tribe of Babylon, as a major tribal area there. So you have Chaldeans on the time, just at that time period, wreaking havoc on Job and his flocks there. So you have another unique token reference in the Bible to that time period.
So that's you're mentioning the Chaldeans there, and I think this is a confusing point for a lot of people, because Babylon, it seems like those terms sometimes are interchangeable, and you're saying that it's just the Chaldeans are a smaller part of the Babylonian Empire. Is that true for just this period, or does it extend out through whenever there's a mention of Chaldea?
That extends essentially on beyond just that period as well. It was a major area in southern Babylon, the Chaldean area, part of the Babylonian Empire. The terms are used interchangeably in the Bible. Historians believe toward the later years, around the 6th and 7th centuries BC, that during that time, the Chaldeans more became known as a term of class, of social class, being of higher standing and social class. But generally, they're used interchangeably. Toward those later times, being more of a higher social standing and class.
Okay. Well, thanks for clearing that up. I know that's kind of been confusing in my mind. So what we've been talking about so far is kind of this first Babylonian Empire, and that was large, I guess, in terms of Nimrod's time, because that's where everybody was, and then kind of fell back once the rise of the Assyrian Empire kind of came on the scene. Although they kind of existed nearby one another, Assyria is kind of in northern Mesopotamia, and Babylon is typically in the south. The Babylon of the Bible that's not related to Abraham, Job, or even Nimrod, that's what we're mostly familiar with. And I wonder if you could just briefly talk about, before we take a break, the intervening years, because we can see during at the end of the Assyrian Empire, it's the Babylonians that kind of take them over. And we're getting into the 7th century now, 8th, 7th century BC. So we've got a big jump from Abraham to there. There's about... I guess close to 900, 800 years. So what happened? Is there anything in the Bible from that intervening period?
Well, you do have a lot of wrangling at that time period with many different empires. The Babylonians, after Hammurabi's time, fell apart to the Elamites, the Elamite Empire, and the Kassites. The Kassites ended up taking over and instituting their own dynasty within Babylon during that time period, during the time that Israel would have been in Egypt. Okay, and then around the time of King David, you have a reemergence of the Babylonian Empire under a Babylonian king, Nebuchadnezzar I. Now, this isn't the famous Nebuchadnezzar from the Bible. That's Nebuchadnezzar II. This is Nebuchadnezzar I at that time. But under his reign, the Babylonians do experience a resurgence, but it's not quite as powerful as the Babylon we are familiar with during the later years. So from his reign, around the time of the start of the kingship over Israel, around David's time, you have a three-way struggle developing among the Assyrians, the Arameans, and the Chaldean tribesmen, basically all trying to control Babylonia. And mostly during that time period, we have Assyrian control over Babylonia. And now that's discussed in the Bible, where the Assyrian king takes over Israel, the northern kingdom of Israel. That was around 720 BC. The northern kingdom of Israel is taken over by the Assyrian king. And what does he do? He takes out those Israelite captives and inserts Babylonians into the land. So this is a clear reference as to how he had control at that time over the Babylonians and was able to move droves of Babylonians into northern Israel. And from them develop our Samaritans that we're familiar with in the Bible. And through the Samaritans, we have this unusual religion that morphed from Babylonian religion with a skewed understanding of the laws of God. And so this is what was going on during that intervening time period before Nebuchadnezzar II came on the scene and really brought great renown to the Babylonian Empire.
All right, we've been talking to Christopher Reams about this article he's written on Babylon. Thanks for that. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we'll discuss the very meat of the Babylonian Empire as it influences and really becomes the dominant force, the dominant outside civilization on the historical events in the Bible. We'll be right back.
KPCG 101.3, Trumpet Radio, is your source of understanding. Trumpet Radio broadcasts from the campus of Herbert W. Armstrong College in Edmond, Oklahoma, and online at kpcg.fm. Thank you for listening. They call it the City of Peace. But it is filled with violence. Yesterday, bloody crusades and sieges. Today, terrorism, rocket attacks and stabbings. Intense international pressure, but no diplomatic solutions. This is Jerusalem. No city has suffered like it. Will there ever be peace? God says yes. There will be peace in Jerusalem, and not just for the Jews. It will be a peace that spreads to all people. How will God bring peace to Jerusalem? Request your free copy of Jerusalem in Prophecy to find out. The answer comes straight from your Bible. Peace is coming soon. Act today. Please visit thetrumpet.com. This is Watch Jerusalem on kpcg.fm.
Welcome back to Watch Jerusalem. We're here discussing an article Christopher Eames has written, an archaeologist and historian, budding historian, and he's been writing these articles about civilizations of the Bible and how they interact with Israel. And we've been talking about the Babylonians here, the last one that he has written. And before the break, we discussed the initial history of the Babylonian Empire and kind of some of the more sketchy details that we have through history of them. But now we're going to move into the period that is very interesting, and especially we've talked about the period of Hezekiah, King Hezekiah, who ruled the latter part of the 8th century BC. And he, of course, as we've discussed on this program, has been well attested to by historical documents from the Bible and also Assyrian documents and Babylonian documents. He is the king that we kind of get the picture from the Bible through events in his life that Assyria is dominant at the beginning, and then by the end of his life, something has happened, and now Babylon is rising in power. I wonder if you could start off talking about that a little bit, Chris.
Sure. Well, we sort of have to begin with this final rise of Babylon's power during the time of King Hezekiah. And this is just after the northern kingdom of Israel was captured by the Assyrians. As we mentioned, the Assyrians supplanted Babylonians into that land. Babylon at that time was still under Assyrian power. But during the time of King Hezekiah, just about a decade or so later, the Assyrians attempted and failed to invade Jerusalem. Hezekiah ended up falling ill. And just after that period of illness, he was met by a group of Babylonian well-wishers, essentially a delegation of ambassadors from Babylon that was at the time ruled by Babylonian king Merodach-Baladan. And this man, described in Isaiah 39, also has been found in archaeology. He's Marduk-Apaladina in the Akkadian language. And he had a semi-autonomous reign underneath the Assyrian general empire. But anyway, this Babylonian king sends his ambassadors to Israel, to King Hezekiah. King Hezekiah is flattered to receive these ambassadors, and he shows them all around his kingdom, showing them his treasures. And just after they left, the prophet Isaiah comes up to Hezekiah and essentially says that, based on what Hezekiah had done, these Babylonians in future are going to come in and they're going to take over Judah. And what you've done is expose Judah to the Babylonians. And so there you have the groundwork laid for what would later become the devastation of Jerusalem under the Babylonian king Nebuchadnezzar. Now, just after Marduk-Apaladina's reign, you have Assyria essentially descending into infighting and chaos. A Chaldean leader comes up to rule Babylon called Nabopolassar, and he gathers essentially the surrounding regional powers and starts sacking Assyrian cities. And the Assyrians here are really on the back foot. They start...
So we're kind of in the mid-7th century about that time,
right? In
the
mid-7th century, and coming towards the 6th century BC. And the Assyrians are defeated in their central capital. They end up moving to a new capital as Babylon is now gaining ground, becoming that Neo-Babylonian empire that they're well known to be. And at this point in time, Egypt is getting quite worried. They're seeing Babylon growing on the world scene. They want to come in and help Assyria put down this Babylonian rebellion. And they attempt to do that at Carchemish, the Battle of Carchemish. But unfortunately for them, at this time period, Babylon has a new ruler, and it is Nebuchadnezzar II. This is the famous Nebuchadnezzar of the Bible. Now, the Egyptians attempt to go and help the Assyrians stop this Babylonian empire expanding at the Battle of Carchemish. The Bible describes this history and describes how the king of Judah at that time, King Josiah, attempted to stop Egypt coming through Judah and helping out the Assyrians with battling the Babylonians. Perhaps we might speculate that Josiah, king of Judah, was biased towards the Babylonians in some way, as his grandfather Hezekiah had been. So he attempted to stop the Egyptians coming in to help the Assyrians against the Babylonians. Now, Josiah was killed during this battle, and the Egyptians made it to the Battle of Carchemish and were able to battle the Babylonians. Now, the prophet Jeremiah actually speaks out about this, Jeremiah 46. Jeremiah says that Egypt will be destroyed by the Babylonians. And what does history record for us? The Egyptians were destroyed by the Babylonians. They end up fleeing back into Egypt. And you have the Babylonians finally and utterly destroying the Assyrian Empire and becoming the regional power. Now, what happens after this time? You have Nebuchadnezzar on the scene, big, strong Babylonian king, and he decides...
So this is kind of the height, right, of even though the Bible... even though this is the one that the Bible focuses on, it's also the reason the Bible focuses so much on them is this is the very height of the Neo-Babylonian Empire.
Right. If the Bible is talking about these empires, it's probably because they're right in the height of their power and they are directly affecting Israel and Judah at that time period. So this was the highest point of Babylon's power. Nebuchadnezzar on the throne, and you have these prophecies from Isaiah saying, originally to Hezekiah and on through the future kings, saying that Jerusalem, because of the sins of the people, will be conquered, Judah and Jerusalem, by the king of Babylon. Now, at the turn of the 6th century BC, ruler over Judah was Jehoiakim. He rebelled against Babylon. It appears he had some kind of a relationship, paying tribute most likely to the king of Babylon. And he rebelled against the king of Babylon. Not a smart thing to do, because Nebuchadnezzar comes into Judah and starts taking over Jerusalem. He takes a number of captives out of the land during that time period. Included among them was Daniel, the prophet, and essentially punishes Jerusalem for rebelling. And after Jehoiakim, his son, Jehoiachin, comes on the throne, and he is actually mentioned in the Babylonian records specifically. Jehoiachin only reigned for about 3 months. He was recorded as being an evil king, and so King Nebuchadnezzar came into Jerusalem again, carted him off, carted off also the descendant of Esther and Mordecai at that time period in the second wave of attacks, and took Jehoiachin back to Babylon. And interestingly, in the Babylonian archives, we have a list of rations to be provided for prisoners, and Jehoiachin is mentioned in those rations as having been a king of Judah, having been a son of the kings of Judah, and having a certain amount of oil rationed to him.
Yeah, I think that is just really interesting history, considering Babylon, as you've brought out, this is going to be the nation that takes Judah into captivity after the warnings of the prophet Jeremiah, and yet Judah would continue to grow even inside their captivity, and we can even see that they are given some, not necessarily favor, but throughout the generations that followed Daniel, well, Daniel's definitely given favor. But then we get into the period after Nebuchadnezzar, and we see Jews living in Babylon. And actually, while they're there for 70 years or so, they are thriving in a certain way. Just before we get to that, though, I would like you just to discuss maybe some of the archaeological discoveries that relate to Babylon's taking of Jerusalem and Judah. You said we've got Jeconiah showing up in Babylon, and he was, well, Jeconiah, Jehoiachin, the same guy. But what else do we have from the actual discoveries in the dirt in Jerusalem of this Babylonian attack?
Sure. Within archaeological excavations at Jerusalem, there are a number of signs that have been discovered of these massive attacks that occurred against Jerusalem. Absolute masses of arrowheads and other weapons dating to this period, these periods of these attacks that have been found. Also, interestingly, at this time period, Jeremiah is on the scene, obviously, and he's prophesying of the fall of Jerusalem to the Babylonians. And what we've also got at this time period are some of the seals or bullae from his archenemies, the princes of Jerusalem. These princes were specifically named Gedaliah and Jehukal. Both of these bullae have been discovered documenting these men exactly as they're listed in the Bible in Jeremiah 37 and Jeremiah 38. Gedaliah, the son of Pashur, and Jehukal, son of Shelemiah. These men are specifically mentioned, them and their fathers, in the Bible, and these clay seals have been found with their exact same names on them, validating the same men that were on the scene during these battles against King Nebuchadnezzar while they were busy fighting Jeremiah, essentially trying to get him either thrown in prison or killed. So you've got the quite a lot of archaeological intrigue at this point in time, not only from the weapons and evidence of battle and burning and fire that happened in Jerusalem, but also from the backstory with the prophet Jeremiah and those that were up against him.
Yeah, I think that's amazing just to think about this destruction layer that exists all over ancient Jerusalem. It details this very time period. It's the very end of the first temple period, and because this is when the first Solomon's temple was destroyed. And after this, we get into a totally different archaeological period with different, on the layer above, basically, different artifacts. You can tell that a change has taken place. But this, as we've been digging in Israel, in the northern parts of the city of David and the Ophel, I mean, this is where you find all those artifacts from the very last days of Judah, because nobody took these away. This is when the destruction took place in the houses. There is massive burn layers that exist. And it was that very fire that of the destruction of Jerusalem at this time that no doubt ensured that the seals that you were talking about were preserved for us to look at, since they're made of clay. They needed to be fired, and then there you are looking in a destruction layer from as Babylon's taking over Judea or Jerusalem, and you have the very people that Jeremiah said should be on the scene are on the scene in the archaeological record.
That's absolutely right, and we have to remember that it's not just Jerusalem being destroyed at this point, but cities throughout Judea. And we do have these parallel artifacts that have been found all across Judea. One other interesting discovery was at Lachish, the second most important city beneath Judea, and this was an inscription on a piece of pottery, and it was a frantic inscription that had been made by a commander in the city or one of the chief officers, essentially saying, "We can't see the beacon from this third city. We know that there should be a fire signal coming from them, letting us know that everything is okay. We can't see this signal." And so that's an interesting snapshot there inscribed into this pottery signal where this third city must have been destroyed at that time by the Babylonians coming
in.
That's
incredible. It's like a, yeah, like you said, they've captured the precise moment that the armies of Babylon are descending into Judah. I think, yeah, you could look those up. They're part of the Lachish letters. I think they're more commonly known as those ostraca with ancient Hebrew texts describing, just like what Chris is saying here, the eyewitness account of the oncoming Babylonians. We don't have too much time, but I do want to give you a little opportunity just to talk about what happens after. The Babylonian Empire continues, obviously, for some years after they conquer Judah and all of the Jews, the Benjamites, the Levites, those tribes in the southern kingdom, they're taken into captivity. But that's not where the history of Babylon ends in the Bible and even in, obviously, secular history as well.
That's right. There are the Jews that got taken off to Babylon and a few Jews that remained, perhaps a few thousand of them, that got together and essentially made a reverse exodus back into Egypt. Jeremiah prophesied that those Jews in Egypt wouldn't be safe from the Babylonians, that the Babylonians are going to come in and invade Egypt. That too has been found in the archaeological records, an inscription describing how the Babylonians swept into Egypt around 568 BC under King Nebuchadnezzar and invaded Egypt. So they certainly suffered again from the Babylonians then. Now, during that time period and on beyond, you have the story of of the prophet Daniel happening, and you have the intersection about Nebuchadnezzar's madness and Daniel 4. And during that period, he undergoes this period of madness where, for his pride and his arrogance, he essentially gets turned into goes out into the field as a beast, essentially, and lives as a beast for 7 years. And interestingly, at the end of the secular history of Nebuchadnezzar's reign, there's 7 years of other kings reigning, three other kings reigning for about 7 years directly after Nebuchadnezzar. So it's interesting to speculate maybe those 7 years are a sign of Nebuchadnezzar being gone from the throne and wandering at that point with the beasts of the field. Now, after this period of Nebuchadnezzar, you have Nabonidus being recorded on the scene, and then also the son of Nabonidus, Belshazzar. Now, the Bible very specifically discusses Belshazzar as having been on the throne of Babylon as the last king of Babylon. And this confused historians for a long time. They knew that Nabonidus was the last king of Babylon. How could it be this Belshazzar that the Bible talks about? Well, an inscription was found in modern-day Iraq in the area of Babylon, and it essentially records a blessing from King Nabonidus onto his son, which is named Belshazzar. So it uniquely links up this name of Belshazzar. Now, how does this fit into the Bible? Well, we know from the secular history that Nabonidus was away from Babylon for much of the time, and he must have set up his son Belshazzar as king over over Babylon proper during this time that Babylon had fallen. And during this time period, you have in the Bible recorded Daniel 5, you have Belshazzar preparing a great feast, and Daniel essentially comes on the scene to interpret this writing that starts appearing on the wall. And according to this writing, Belshazzar is about to lose his throne. And that very night, the Persians sweep in, an absolute miraculous victory for them. And one night, they take all of Babylon, all of the city of Babylon. They kill Belshazzar and take Nabonidus captive. Now, this matches up exactly with the biblical record, because as Daniel is interpreting this writing on the wall, Belshazzar offers him the third position on the throne of Babylon. Right. Now, why would it be the third position on the throne of Babylon? Why not the second if Belshazzar was number one? Well, it fits exactly with the secular history. Belshazzar was number two. Nabonidus was actually number one. He was away from Babylon. Belshazzar was number two. So he only had the third position to give to Daniel on the throne. So an amazing linking of the biblical record there with secular history.
I think that's probably a good spot to end. I hope we've whet the appetite of some people to go back. There is so much more in this article. It's about 4,500 words, 12 pages as I printed it out and before in preparation for this, and worried I was going to spend too much money on paper. But it's definitely worth your time to go back and read all of this, and especially just finishing with that anecdote or this history of Belshazzar, because it's just a great reminder of historians that come along and say the Bible's incorrect, we haven't found this person or that person. And I don't like this. This is a great example, because history up to the discovery of this Babylonian document that talks about Belshazzar being there as the co-regent, basically, there was no mention of him outside the Bible. So people naturally thought, well, he didn't exist. He didn't exist, and the Bible's making this up. Well, give it time. Give it time, and eventually the biblical history will be proven. There are lots of characters inside the Bible that we don't have a historical record for outside of the Bible. But that's the same as what we had for Belshazzar as well. Give it some time. Conduct some more digs. Don't approach it from the premise that the Bible is wrong unless proven by an outside source. How about approach it from the premise, hey, the Bible's probably telling the right history, and sooner or later, if we conduct enough excavations, if we study these documents well enough, we're going to find those biblical characters as well. Thank you very much, Christopher Reams, for taking your time to talk with us today. And more importantly, thank you very much for detailing the history of Babylon in this article. This can be really encouraging for people to study through this history and just see how well the Bible matches up to secular history. Thanks very much.
No problem. Been a pleasure.
We're at the end of another program of Watch Jerusalem. If you'd like to send us your feedback, you can do that by sending us emails with the email address letters@watchjerusalem.co.il. I am making an effort to get back to you. Sometimes it takes me a few days or possibly even a few weeks, but I will respond eventually. And especially if you're in the Jerusalem area and you would like a tour of the City of David or the Ophel excavations, I'd be happy to give you that as well. So send us an email. Or you can, of course, contact us through Twitter or Facebook as well. Thanks very much once again for listening, and we'll see you next week.